Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's Midday on Medicine. Today, psychedelic psychiatry. Psychedelic drugs long associated with 1960s counterculture are emerging as promising new therapies for treating addiction, depression, and PTSD. California and Oregon have relaxed laws that restrict the use of psychedelics, and the research is attracting investors. How can these drugs be used safely, and what is the proper way to regulate them? My guests today are two of the leading experts in this burgeoning field. Dr. Rick Doblin is the founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Dr. Roland Griffiths directs the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins. They join me after the news. Hey, everybody. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you can hang with us today. For months, the world's leading science journals have been filled with news of medical research trials for drugs to treat disorders such as post-traumatic stress syndrome, clinical depression, and drug and alcohol addiction. What makes these treatments so remarkable is that they employ two powerful psychedelics or hallucinogenic compounds that provide patients with significant and lasting relief. The startling results have springboarded these once taboo drugs, psilocybin and MDMA, into mainstream medicine. Both psychedelics appear to be moving toward eventual FDA approval for clinical therapeutic use. Some states have already made them legal. Today on Midday, the perils and potential of psychedelic psychiatry. Two of the nation's leading researchers in this burgeoning field join me for the hour. Dr. Rick Doblin is the founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. MAPS is a nonprofit research, education, and advocacy organization. Dr. Doblin leads more than 100 neuroscientists, pharmacologists, and regulatory specialists on a mission to bring psychedelic psychiatry into the medical mainstream. Dr. Doblin joins us on our digital line from Boston. Doctor, welcome. And doctor, are you there? Can you hear me?
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
And we are delighted to have you. Dr. Roland Griffiths is a psychopharmacologist and professor of psychiatry and neurosciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's also a specialist in mind-altering meditation practices and the founding director of the Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. He's the author of a landmark study in 2006 showing the beneficial effects of psilocybin, and Dr. Griffith joins us from Baltimore on Zoom. Hi, doctor. Welcome as well.
Hi, pleased to join you.
And listeners, if you have questions or comments about psychedelic psychiatry, we'll take calls a little bit later in the program, but meanwhile, you're welcome to email us, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us as well, @midday_WYPR. Dr. Doblin, let me start with you. Can you define what we're talking about when we talk about these pharmacological compounds that are described as psychedelics?
Yeah, the word was originally created in the 1950s, psychedelic, meaning to manifest the mind. So what I mean is these are drugs that bring to the surface experiences, memories, thoughts, feelings that have been usually below the level of conscious awareness. But it's kind of like dreams. We all have this membrane between the conscious and the unconscious mind, and we experience them every night in dreams. So it's something similar to that. It's this emergence into awareness. And it's kind of a neutral word, psychedelic. It's neither positive nor negative. It's neither necessarily spiritual nor delusionary like hallucinogenic. It's just things that we might not normally experience, or that we might have for PTSD, we might have difficulties remembering them because they're painful, and these drugs can help those memories be come to awareness and processed emotionally.
And Dr. Griffiths, are there any other substances or any other practices? I mean, I'm thinking about things like meditation, which is, I know, something that you've studied a lot. Are there other venues, other ways of getting to that mental state that Dr. Doblin's talking about, that membrane between the conscious and unconscious. Is there anything similar, analogous to psychedelics?
Well, probably countless alternative ways. But meditation classically is an investigation of the very nature of mind. It's not a very easy practice to undertake. Most people get frustrated with it very quickly. But, there are also alternative practices like breath work practices and contemplative practices that allow one to investigate the nature of mind. The psychedelics, the classic psychedelics, such as psilocybin and LSD and the close cousins, such as MDMA, are unusual because of the high probability that they occasion these remarkable kinds of experiences and the abruptness with which they do so.
And listeners, we're having a little bit of a delay on our line with Dr. Doblin, but I'm going to go back to him now. So, Doctor, I'd like to ask both of you to describe your own experience, your personal experience with psychedelics, how you first encountered them, and how that initial experience or those initial experiences informed your research. So, Dr. Doblin, let me start with you.
Yeah, well, I first had an experience with psychedelics back in 1971 when I was a college freshman, and it was with LSD. And then later I had experiences with mescaline, which is from the peyote cactus or the San Pedro cactus. And of all the psychedelics, MDMA is most similar to mescaline. And the first thing that I recognized when I was having those experiences was that they were bringing me in touch with my emotions, that I had been very cerebral, very cognitive, and had not had a very rich emotional life. And these experiences brought me deeper into my emotions. And then they also had this sense of dissolving a bit my ego, who I thought I was, and my orientation about me as the center of the universe, in a sense. And they brought me in touch with kind of the sweep of history and the way in which I was part of a much bigger fabric of life, family, the history, the development, the evolution. So intimations of this deeper spiritual sense of unity. And once I experienced that, I thought that these drugs could have incredible potential to help me mature and grow up, and that they could also have incredible potential to help large number of other people. You know, I'd heard a lot about other people taking psychedelics, and I didn't really understand fully until I had tried them myself, and I thought that they had...
Okay, so we're having a little trouble with Dr. Doblin's line, and we're going to work on that now. But let me go to Dr. Griffiths. Dr. Griffiths, as I mentioned, you had a great interest in meditation. What is your, what was your first experience with psychedelics yourself, and how did that then, evolve into the research that you've been doing now for quite a while?
Well, it wasn't an experience with psychedelics. It was an experience with meditation that drew me into this entire area. So I'm trained as a psychopharmacologist, had done research, clinical research on mood-altering drugs for decades at Hopkins, undertook a meditation practice that got me deeply interested in the nature of mind and the nature of these emergent experiences, some people would call them transformative experiences or religious experiences or spiritual experiences. They go by peak experiences, they go by many names. But I became deeply interested in that process, and then reacquainted with this older literature on psychedelics that made the claim that these compounds could occasion those kinds of experiences.
And Dr. Griffiths, are you there? Can you hear me? We might have lost Dr. Griffiths there for a second, who's joining us on Zoom. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to try to fix these technical problems. My guests are Dr. Roland Griffiths. He's the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Conscientious Research here in Baltimore. Dr. Rick Doblin's on the line from Boston. He's the founder and executive director of MAPS. That's the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Listeners, we'd be interested to hear what you have to say, interested in your own experience with psychedelics, your own feelings about whether or not they should be legalized, whether or not they should be used in a medical context, whether they should be used in a recreational context. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. Dr. Griffiths, we lost you for a second, but I'm told we have you back. So please forgive us and explain then how that interest in meditative practice then continued on or informed the work that you've been doing ever since.
Yeah, so not sure where I got cut off, but I'd had some very compelling experiences with meditation, became reacquainted with this older literature on psychedelics. But of course, research with psychedelics had been essentially forbidden for some decades prior to my beginning interest in this, which was about 20 years ago. So it was by no means clear we could get approval to even study psilocybin, and that was the psychedelic we chose to study. But we persevered. We did get approval. This was the first such approval to give a psychedelic, a high dose of psychedelic, to otherwise psychedelic naive individuals at high doses in some almost 20 years before that. And the results, frankly, were absolutely outstanding to me, just remarkable. People ended up the way we give the psychedelic is we carefully screen people, we prepare them before the sessions. On a session, they take a capsule. We have them lay on a couch with eye shades and headphones through which they listen to a program of music. We ask them to direct their attention on their inner experience, and we don't intervene therein. We just ask them to attend to what's going on. This was in healthy volunteers. And of course, under those conditions, people have the kinds of experiences you'd have expected on psychedelics. So there are visual changes, there are emotional changes, sometimes excitedness or happiness or spiritual experiences, but also fear, anxiety may come up. There may be cognitive changes, but those all resolve at the end of the day. The interesting feature of this was that months after the session, talking to people about their experience several months earlier, people ended up saying things like, well, that experience was one of the most personally meaningful and spiritually significant experience of my entire lifetime. And at the time, it never occurred to me that we could ask a question of that sort. It never occurred to me, having given, you know, dozens of psychoactive drugs to people at high doses, that such an effect is even possible. But indeed, that is it. These are experiences of deep personal meaning. And therein lies the groundwork for the therapeutic applications, because people end up with a altered worldview and a way of re-engaging with their lives and how they hold themselves and their disease in a way that they hadn't formerly been able to do so.
Yeah, so Dr. Doblin, let me explore that a little more deeply. Dr. Griffiths is talking about his work with, you know, healthy individuals, people who are not suffering from things like PTSD or addiction. But when someone does present with those problems and those challenges. How exactly do the psychedelics help that person get better? Because there is some research that I've read about that says that not only does it work, but it works way more quickly than typical, for example, in the case of depression. Typical treatments for depression can take months and years to be effective, but there's some indication in some early studies that psychedelics are working considerably more quickly. Why is that? How does it work?
Well, first let me say that the studies that we've done are not so much early anymore. We've been at this for about 20 years, and we're in what's called phase three, which is the final stage of research where you do placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized studies designed to prove safety and efficacy. And we've just published the results from our first of two phase three studies, which was highly successful. So it's not early stages, but we're not quite there yet. We need to finish the second phase three study. But as to how does it work, the people who struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder have memories of trauma that never really get fully processed. They're not so much in the past, but they seem like they're always about to happen or always happening. There's triggers, reminders that people have. They have nightmares. The thoughts and memories come to them in their dreams. It's never really quite processed. It's always quite there in the present. And how MDMA helps is it reduces activity in the amygdala, the part of the brain where we process fear, and it reduces activity so that the memories that have normally been so connected to painful emotions, people have better access to the memory of the trauma, but the emotional content is different, and that they're also a sense of well-being, a sense of acceptance. There's a release of oxytocin, which is the hormones of nursing mothers, of love and connection. It helps build a therapeutic relationship. And people are able to think more carefully. There is enhanced activity in the prefrontal cortex where people think logically. And so what we see under the influence of MDMA and PTSD patients, and we work with severe PTSD patients, the hardest cases. We even enroll people that have previously attempted to kill themselves in our studies. And they're able to get out of these patterns of fear and let out the emotions. You could say it's like a process of grief when people have someone that they love has died and the emotions are bottled up, and then you can let it out in tears. There's this release of the emotions connected to the experience that has a healing process. And it's also, there's a connectivity between the hippocampus and the amygdala, where the hippocampus, where we put memories into long-term storage. So these traumatic memories that have been on the surface and coming in dreams and all sorts of reminders, people are able to process the feelings and then place them in the past as if they're no longer happening. They're a part of the story, but they're not the whole story. And it's within a therapeutic context, a supportive therapeutic context, where we have usually a two-person therapy team, usually a male and female, but not always. And they support people as these experiences come to the surface. So in a sense, you could say that instead of trying to suppress the symptoms, we make the symptoms, the feelings, more accessible, come to the surface and be processed. And then it's like after a storm has passed, there's a sense of peace and people are able to move forward with their lives.
Dr. Rick Doblin is the founder and executive director of MAPS, the Boston-based Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Dr. Roland Griffiths is the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research here in Baltimore. Our conversation will continue after a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your calls and emails and tweets, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday WIPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWIPR. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, the authors Tom Chalkley and Brennan Jensen will join me to discuss their delightful new book. It's called A History Lover's Guide to Baltimore. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join us with reviews of Single Carrot Theater's new streaming production of I Hope This Finds You and the Roundhouse Theater's new virtual play We're Gonna Die. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the emergence of psychedelic drugs as treatments for PTSD and other disorders. My guests are Dr. Rick Doblin. He's the founder and executive director of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. He's on the line from Boston. And Dr. Roland Griffiths is the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. He joins us from here in Charm City. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. And Dr. Griffiths, let me ask you a little bit more about the sessions that you have with people who are both healthy and others who are dealing with various challenges like depression, addiction, that sort of thing. You mentioned that there's a program of music that's very specifically thought out. You decide what to start with and what to move on to and through the course of the thing. How long are these sessions? What's the time frame? And what are the dangers? I mean, are there what are the things that when you have people either volunteer for the trials or people who are, you know, trying to be treated, what do you tell them to be aware of as the potential downside to taking these substances?
Yes. So with respect to the duration of sessions, people take a capsule in the morning. The effects of psilocybin come on fairly quickly, about 30 minutes. Peak effects occur at about 2 to 3 hours. And by the end of the day, late afternoon, early evening, people are generally back to baseline. With respect to warnings we give people, and that is that very difficult experiences may emerge, and we ask people to be interested and curious about whatever it is that emerges in mind, and recognize that there's actually nothing about these experiences that can harm them. And that if they are curious and interested, they're going to learn a lot about the very nature of mind. I would like to say something about the therapeutic indications, because the MAPS group is focusing specifically on PTSD. With psilocybin, which is, again, it's pharmacologically different than MDMA, we're going after a variety of therapeutic targets. The lead target is depression, and there's very promising data showing that psilocybin is a very good treatment for both major depressive disorder and very likely treatment-resistant depression. We have also shown efficacy in end-of-life anxiety and depression, and there's efficacy in treatment of the addictions. We have an active program in cigarette smoking cessation enhanced by psilocybin. We're just starting a study. We're recruiting now for alcoholism associated with depression. We also have a study of depressed mood associated with early Alzheimer's. And we have a study in anorexia nervosa. So it's this wide therapeutic generality that is probably the most remarkable feature of this as a psychiatric pharmacological intervention. And one could ask, well, how in the world is that possible? Because we're accustomed to psychiatric medications being very, very specifically targeted to neurochemical systems. So with depression, SSRIs that target the serotonin system is really the treatment of choice. And with opiate addiction, for instance, it might be an opiate agonist. And here we're treating a variety of conditions, essentially with the same compound, but there's a different therapeutic package around that. And I think that the secret here about how it works, I mean, we actually don't, full disclosure, we don't fully understand it. I mean, there are basic neurological changes that occur that is called neuroplasticity that may account for some of these changes. But it also appears that the experience itself engenders this shift in worldview, a shift in self, a shift in a sense of self-efficacy, willingness to tolerate discomfort, and willingness to re-engage with life in a way that patients haven't formally been able to do. And that's the remarkable feature of psilocybin.
That really is quite extraordinary. We have an email from a listener, Josie, who says, I wanted to contribute to this conversation. I tried magic mushrooms recently, and it helped me immensely with my depression, anxiety, grief, and trauma. I've been in therapy for some time and would compare psychedelics to accelerated therapy in the right context. But it should be absolutely legalized, although I'd support regulations so that people don't try this for the first time without emotional support throughout the experience. So Dr. Doblin, you mentioned that you're in phase three of clinical trials. What do you anticipate that a possible timeline could be for this treatment to be approved by the FDA and sort of mainstreamed and have it become a fairly common approach to the treatment of PTSD, for example, that you're working on?
Well, we now are in the process of completing our second phase three study, which will be done about a year and 3 months from now. We're thinking about October or so of 2022. And we think by the end of 2022, very early 2023, we will submit the full application called NDA, New Drug Application, to the FDA. And we think before the end of 2023, if our second phase three study does even close to as well as our first phase three study, that we should have approval for prescription use. And we think that what will be happening after that will be the establishment of clinics where people can receive these experiences under direct supervision. It's not going to be a take-home drug. It'll be only administered under direct supervision of therapists. And we think over the decade, as psilocybin becomes approved and other psychedelics, we already have about 300 or so clinics where ketamine is administered for depression, in many of those without psychotherapy, but often the therapists are coming along and administering that with psychotherapy. We think by the end of the decade, there will be thousands of these psychedelic clinics, and there will be about 30,000 or so therapists trained in the use of these substances. And that will continue to increase as time goes by. And so we're very hopeful about insurance coverage. That's the other big aspect of this, which is, are these treatments cost effective? Because they are labor intensive. The treatment is not the drug, like most psychiatric medications. It's just about the medication. But this is really therapy that the medication helps to be more effective. And so I think the challenge is going to be persuading insurance companies that it is cost effective. And the one argument there that we think is going to be persuasive is that what we can tell now is that these experiences are durable. You've heard from Dr. Griffiths also that with psilocybin, these experiences last. And so they're actually very cost effective. And so we think the future is very bright for the use of these in psychotherapy.
Dr. Rick Doblin of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Dr. Roland Griffiths is here as well. He's with the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday, 410-662-8780. Email midday at WIPR.org or at midday WIPR in the Twittersphere. We have an email from Summer in Mount Vernon, who says, microdosing magic mushrooms on a daily basis has provided relief from lifelong depression that no traditional Western medicine ever has. I also have had many high-dose experiences as well, and they were some of the most meaningful experiences of my life and helped me process through PTSD, addiction, and even the death of my little brother. It brought me great peace, and I felt what I can only equate to the comforting sense that deeply religious individuals speak of when they pray. So again, another listener, you know, equating the experience of the drug to a religious and spiritual experience. Let's go to John, who's on the line from Westminster. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. John here. Listen, thank you, first of all, for bringing this to air. It's such an important topic, and I want to thank the doctors for the work they're doing. This is potentially life-altering work that they're doing. My question toes in sort of with the last question you had. It's about microdosing. I know that the doctors seem to be studying macrodosing on a rather probably infrequent basis, I imagine. And I wonder if there's any possibility, sure there is, but to look at a future microdosing regime on a more frequent basis for these psychedelics.
Yeah, Dr. Griffiths, what do you think? I mean, it sounds like this emailer says that she's been doing microdosing, you know, on a pretty regular basis for a while. Is that a normal approach?
Well, let's see. It's caught the public imagination, and there's an awful lot of anecdotal support for microdosing. Frankly, the science isn't there yet. We need to catch up with the culture and do the studies. But at the present time, we can't say with any certainty that the efficacy of microdosing has been demonstrated. I would like to just make one comment, because I'd be really remiss not to just underscore the potential risks associated with, particularly with high dose psychedelics. And although the frequency of these is extraordinarily low under conditions where we carefully screen people, we prepare them before sessions, we support them during and after sessions, that's not always the case when these compounds are taken by people who might be vulnerable to certain psychiatric conditions or under conditions in which it's just unwise and unsupported. So these compounds can result in vulnerable people in enduring psychiatric conditions, the worst of which would be schizophrenia, a permanent psychotic disorder. Again, it's not frequent, but it occurs. And when it does, it's catastrophic for the individual. The other area of potential hazard, more frequent certainly than enduring psychiatric illness, is that people will become confused, disoriented, panic, and engage in dangerous behavior, life-threatening dangerous behavior to themselves or others. And that's, of course, tragic. It's avoidable. But one of the concerns that we need to have as a culture is that these compounds need to be administered and taken under conditions where people are protected from that kind of outcome.
Well, we have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about that, because there are some places, Oregon, California, the city of Denver, where recreational use of psilocybin and psychedelics has been approved, at least in the initial stages. Dr. Roland Griffiths is the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research in Baltimore. Dr. Rick Doblin is the founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. More when we come back, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. We'll be right back.
Talking backwards and the Red Queens are
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, we're talking about psychedelic psychiatry and the use of psychedelic drugs in the treatment of a variety of disorders. For 50 years, psychedelic drugs have been classified as Schedule 1 substances or dangerous drugs, but efforts are underway to change that designation. A poll last year showed 51% of adults in the UK and the United States support the legalization of psychedelics for medicinal use. And earlier this month, the California Senate passed a bill to decriminalize personal use of psychedelics and establish a commission to study how the drugs could be safely regulated. The city of Denver, Colorado, and the state of Oregon decriminalized psilocybin in 2019. Dr. Roland Griffiths is the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. Dr. Rick Doblin's the founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies up in Boston. They're with us until the top of the hour. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. WIPR. Dr. Doblin, what about this categorization, this designation of psychedelics as level one, substance one, schedule one substances? Do you advocate that that designation be changed? And if so, to what? And what's your reasoning?
Well, there's two aspects of that. For medical use, the Schedule 1 means a high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical use and no safety under medical supervision. And so that can only be changed either by Congress or by the FDA and the Drug Enforcement Administration after submission of evidence demonstrating safety and efficacy for a particular medical condition. So we anticipate that if our second phase 3 study goes well, that we will be applying to the FDA to have the drugs rescheduled, to have MDMA rescheduled for PTSD. And we're going to be proposing either Schedule 3 or Schedule 4 for that to be a much lesser degree of control. But that would still potentially leave the non-medical use in Schedule 1. And I think that the entire system that we have of drug prohibition is counterproductive and has more harms than benefits, and it blocks a lot of people from having these experiences in ways with pure drugs, with proper support. So, for example, the Oregon Psilocybin Initiative, which has recently been passed, but it's going to have a 2-year period before it goes and implements, will have a state regulated system of trained guides that will be able to work with people with both a medical condition, but also people who are looking for personal growth that don't necessarily have a diagnosis. And I think that those experiences like that should be permitted. So I do think that the situation that we currently have is not ideal at all and has been used, the drug war has been used in ways that are suppressing minorities in a racist manner. And I think that one of the earlier, I think it was an email, somebody said that they hoped that that these drugs would be legalized, but that the first experience that people have, they wanted to be under some sort of supervision. And I think that makes a lot of sense. So what we're actually proposing is what we call licensed legalization. Now, that's outside of medicine. So for medicine, it becomes prescription drug in the lower schedule, but also licensed legalization, the way we mean that would be that these thousands of psychedelic clinics that are going to be set up, that they could also become sites of initiation where somebody would go to have an experience under MDMA or psilocybin or LSD or something like that, but in a supervised way so that they understand what they're getting into. And if that goes well, then they get a license to purchase it on their own. And then if they misbehave under the influence of the drug, they end up being punished for whatever they did in their misbehavior, but they could also lose their license for a while and have more education. And I think that's the more responsible way to go forward. But I think that the current system is really not ideal at all. And I think that there are many, many benefits that society would have, but it has to be incorporated with treatment on demand, with honest drug education, and an overall system of harm reduction that's put into place so that society is prepared to handle these experiences.
And Dr. Griffiths, we have a question from Christine, who says, how about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder? My son suffers from this. Would psychedelics help?
We believe so. In fact, we have a protocol under development and expecting to launch probably within the year on OCD treatment. There are so many potential possibilities for treatment, and we're just beginning to scratch the surface. But there's some preliminary data from other institutions suggesting efficacy of psilocybin in treatment of OCD.
Yeah, and it, you know, you listed off a whole list of other disorders that you're all working on. So the list is certainly quite long. Let's go to the phones again to John, who's on the line from Timonium. John, welcome to Midday with Dr. Griffiths and Dr. Doblin.
Thank you. This is a great program. After 30 years of doing meditation, after I had dabbled a little bit with LSD, I found that meditation was great for problem solving and also for the creative side of things. It kind of opened up juxtapositions of ideas, experiences, and stimuli. And I'm wondering, first of all, what's the efficacy in terms of functionality of those that are challenged and who receive these therapies? The second question is, why can't we focus more on meditation as a source of, I guess you could say, opening the mind for those that are creative problem solvers, business people, as an example?
Dr. Griffiths, that's an area that you do a lot of work in, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because as I mentioned, my entry point into this research field was through meditation. I still have a regular meditation practice. And in fact, we have done studies, these are non-therapeutic studies, of psilocybin in beginning meditators and in long-term meditators. My own sense of this is that meditation and psilocybin are both ways to investigate the nature of mind. As I mentioned earlier, meditation is a more difficult and less immediate route to follow, but it results in more stable practice. One of the interesting findings among our long-term meditators who had spent decades of daily practice in meditation and had not had experience with psychedelics prior to involvement in our study was that by and large, they all found the experience to be remarkably insightful and interesting. They claimed it benefited their meditation practice. However, they were, I think, to the absolutely across the board, convinced that it was certainly no replacement for meditation, because meditation results in much greater stability and understanding nature of mind.
And Dr. Doblin, when it comes to regulating these drugs, you mentioned, you know, the possibility of thousands of psychedelics centers, et cetera, and the education that's involved, the insurance aspect of this. Are there models at the state level that you look to as good paradigms for federal, you know, national regulation and oversight of this this industry, which very, very likely, it seems, will soon become a very lucrative and very, very large industry. I mean, there are people investing already in it, and there are some expectations that this will be a multi-billion-dollar business, much like medical cannabis has already become in the not-so-distant future. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true as to the growth of this industry. You know, there's already several publicly traded for-profit psychedelic companies that have multi-billion dollar market caps. And as far as models, we really don't have many good models. These drugs have been, you know, criminalized. The research is still in the early stages. We haven't really had any approvals yet of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. There are places like in Amsterdam where certain kinds of mushrooms are legal, and now there's multiple centers there where people are coming from around the world to have experiences under supervision. I think that's somewhat of a good model. In Jamaica, there's certain areas where mushrooms are made available for people, and people are coming. But as far as in the United States, the only models that we have now are areas where, like in Denver, where the mushrooms have been decriminalized, or in Oakland, or in Ann Arbor, and Somerville, and Cambridge. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Those are not legal commerce. There's no people setting up psychedelic clinics. There are some clinics with a drug called Ibogaine, which is excellent for helping people withdraw from opiates. But Ibogaine is illegal in the United States for no good reason, but it's legal in Mexico and Canada, in England, in much of the world. And there are these Ibogaine clinics. So I think the model that makes the most sense for therapy are these clinic settings where people have medical screening, they have psychotherapeutic support. And the models for what we would call a post-prohibition world are still being developed. We have an agreement with the city of Denver where we're going to be training initially about 40 police officers on what they should do to be helpful if they encounter people with difficult mushroom trips or other psychedelic trips, where Dr. Griffiths has talked about how sometimes people can have a difficult reaction to it. And that is very much the case. And we're trying to train the police. And then if that works, we'll train thousands of the first responders in Denver to know how to de-escalate, how to get people the help that they need, how to support them. But we're in the very early stages, and that's why we are needing to be careful and cautious as we move forward. And we are needing to look very carefully at what we do, since we're in the process of really creating the initial models. And I'm sure they'll be refined over time as we develop them.
Well, I very much appreciate your participation in this really interesting conversation today. And we will continue to follow this, because this is clearly something that is just in the early stages and in the beginning parts of, you know, becoming part of an experience that I think a lot more people are going to end up having at some point. This is Dr. Roland Griffiths. He's the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research here in Baltimore. Dr. Griffiths, thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And if any of the listeners want to know more about the studies that are ongoing, they can look us up online and see what's happening.
And Dr. Rick Doblin, he's with the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Dr. Doblin, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. And also, people could go to MAPS, M-A-P-S, MAPS.org to learn more about what we're doing and to see our protocols and our papers and all sorts of associated material.
Great. And we'll have all that stuff on our website as well, WIPR.org/midday. Here and Now is next, coming up after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.